Good evening, TigerCast fans. Welcome to a very special show on this Monday night. Hope everyone is doing well, and we are back on the winners list officially. Thank goodness. A little bit of heart and mouth moment in the first quarter in a bit, but we finally got the 4 points at the end, and it is good to be back on the board. So, EJ, welcome to you, mate. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, back. It's been a while.
Yeah. You're off sort of jet-setting around. You're in Bali. You're all over the shop.
Yeah, then came back and got COVID for the first time. I dodged it for a couple of years. And
yeah. Now
the camera looks like I'm missing the top half of my head. So let's just get through.
The blur feature does wonders. So, and as you can see, folks, we do have a very special guest in the house. Drafted as a father-son selection by the Tigers in 95, played 265 games, kicked 171 goals, two-time All-Australian, two-time Jack medalist, AFL NT Team of the Century and AFL NT Hall of Fame, Joel Bowden. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And a big shout out as well to Nick. Thank you so much, Nick, for helping organise Joel to jump on. So we really appreciate your time tonight, mate. I suppose, firstly, we'll wind back the clock all the way back to your debut year. You made your debut against the Hawks in 96. What was it like running out with the team for the first time after getting onto the list as a father-son?
Oh, it was fabulous. I remember the warm-up more than the game itself because I sat on the bench for pretty much the entire first half, came on very late in the first half, and then spent the rest of the second half pretty much on the bench, where I then came on late, and I think I had one kick and one handball. So, you know, a very big game, and got more touches in the warm-up than I did during the game.
It's funny, it works so differently these days, doesn't it? Like, as if back when you were playing, it was, you had your stint on the ground and that was it. No benefit of the rotation where you're sort of on and off.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and I got dropped the next week. So I got a game after, I think it was round 16 or 17. So I'd played, you know, a lot of reserves footy back when we had reserves in the mid-90s. And then, I got a game. We played at Princes Park against Hawthorn. The warm-up was almost surreal because, you know, I knew I'd be running out there to play. And then, I watched, like most other people, watched the game sitting down and then jumped on, you know, for 5 minutes, I think, before halftime and maybe 5 minutes before the end of the game. Got the sack the next week.
Is that hard to change, to tweak your mindset to go, right, I'm actually now in the game now, I've got to actually see ball, get ball, and actually have an impact on the contest when sitting down for so long?
Oh, not really. They used to make us run up and down the boundary line, you know, every 4 or 5 minutes to keep warm, just in case we got on the field. And I do remember getting on the field, and I got a ground ball. The ball was bobbling through the middle. I ran over, picked it up, and I was very nervous, very, very nervous. But I was glad it stuck in my hands, and I handballed it off as quickly as I could. Because I was a little bit worried that someone was going to tackle me and drive me into the ground.
I suppose teams often do go after the first gamers, don't they? During your first few years at the club, did you happen to have any mentors, or was there anyone at the club that you tried to emulate their training habits or the way they played or anything like that?
Well, we had a buddy system for a while, which was good. And I teamed up with Paul Broderick, who demonstrated clearly in 1996 that he was the best trainer, and he won the best and fairest, I believe, in 96 as well. So he's clearly one of the best players. And so I tried to follow him around at training. I tried to run with him around the tan. I tried to catch up with him outside of the club as well. So I remember, you know, going over there for dinner a couple of times, and Greg Deer would also come around, because Greg Deer and Brodders were good friends. So, you know, Brodders was probably the one that I followed as much as I could. But I also got to know Brendan Gale reasonably quickly, because he was friends with my brother, Sean, who played at Richmond, you know, a few years earlier and played with Brendan. So immediately when I got there, there was a couple of guys that I was sort of shadowing. And then, you know, when you get drafted, or when I got drafted, I should say, there was five or six guys who'd just come into the club as well. So we were all doing our stuff together. We're all doing our weights together. We're all trying to do a little bit extra before training, and catch up as much as we could. And, you know, I remember just in the gym, we were always encouraging each other just to lift a little bit more to see if we could. I think back then we were trying to bench press 80 kilos or something in our first year, which was a lot then, you know. We were trying to get to 80 kilos and we were trying to put on weight as well. So we're all eating as many, as much food as we possibly could and getting as many kicks and handballs that we could. It was good. I enjoyed it. I'd come from Alice Springs and that was what I wanted to do. And there I was. I did an AFL traineeship in my first year, 96. And then we'd go straight from there and we'd go to the club and start kicking and catching the ball.
Awesome. Well, I'm a little bit older than Chris. So we get to 2001 and you play in the final series. What was that like, that experience? I mean, obviously at the time, you know, we talk about now the era. I mean, I was 9 years old in 1980. And when we lost in 82, the grand final, I just thought, oh, yeah, that's all right. A couple of years' time, we'll be back. Obviously, we had 95. You get to 2001, you're playing the final series. What was it like and what was the difference between, for you, how much difference did you feel from a home and away game?
Yeah, it's an interesting period of time for Richmond, Nick. And, you know, I'm not quite as old as you, sorry, mate. I was alive in 80, let's just say that. But I lived through, you know, that 37 years of Richmond not being successful premiership-wise, but I had the memories of my father playing in a premiership in 69 and knowing the history of the football club. I was overjoyed to be drafted in 1995. You know, they drafted you the year before. And Richmond had just played off in a preliminary final. Got whacked by Geelong out at Waverley. That was unceremonious. And then it took us, and it took me, really, it took me a long time to figure out how to play AFL footy and what was required. I don't suspect in today's game that players would get the same amount of time. Like I probably was given 4 or 5 years to really figure it out and get my body and my mind to a point where I could play consistent footy. And that was 2001. We had a strong team. Again, Brendan Gale, Paul Broderick were still there. And we had a fabulous season and we won a lot of games by a narrow margin. I think we might have won 5 or 6 games by 2 goals or less. And that got us into the finals. We played the first final against Essendon, who we played in round 22, and they walloped us. We beat them in round 22, and then they walloped us in the first final. So we, you know, left with our tail between our legs, and then we had Carlton the next week at the G, which we built up for. We started really well, and then we got them. And I just remember when Kuda got injured that we sort of knew we had him. He slipped boundary throw-in, I think it was, over on the members' wing, and he went down and he went off. And he was Superman, like Anthony Koutafidis during that 99-2000 period. No one in my experience has played better football over a 3 or 4 month period in that 99 season when he was only 15 marks, 15 kicks, 15 handballs and 5 goals. It was phenomenal. And so when we got to that point in the game, I think it was in the third quarter, if I remember correctly, I think we knew that we'd done enough and we were going to play a prelim. The problem was we went to the Gabba and we played the Almighty Lions. I thought we were a chance, but, you know, they were the super team of that period of time. And as much as we battled and battled, they still did us by 10 goals up at the Gabba. And, you know, we came home. I thought the year after that we could, you know, we could continue and do well again. But unfortunately, my career, which was 14 years long, that was the one final series that I got to play in.
Yeah, Kuda was unbelievable. I actually went to a Carlton-Hawthorn game just to do nothing but sit there and watch him for the game. He was nuts. That sort of period there where, you know, a lot of the jokes emanated from, the ninth man jokes and stuff like that, it must have been incredibly frustrating to just miss on on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah, look, Nick, I probably wasn't aware as much as I should have been of the outside influences. I really did knuckle down and try and do the best I possibly could and try and do the best we possibly could. I think the stability or lack of stability in the club hurt us at times. And when I say instability, we had coaches for 5 years. Danny was there for 5 years. Terry was there for 5 years. But we didn't have a level of maturity, I think, that Brendan Gale, Peggy, were able to exhibit and instill in the club during that period of time when Damien Hardwick was struggling, you know, when there was the calls for him to go and there was the, you know, the mooted board changeover. And that level of maturity, I think, that we didn't quite have at the time. And that may have settled the players down a bit more. That may have, you know, that may have settled me down a bit more, made me a bit more aware of it. At times, I think, and if I reflect on it, I think, you know, we're always in this mentality of, you know, we're doing what we think's best, so therefore we'll be okay. You know, and that doesn't always work. Sometimes you do need outside influences. Sometimes you do need, you know, fresh ideas to take you to a level that you haven't been to before. I also think our recruiting wasn't great either at different times, and we didn't capitalize on opportunities we had with draft picks that were, you know, really, really high. But you're in the lap of the gods with the draft. You know, who would have thought that you know, if you draft Lance Franklin or Jared Roughead, you'll go on to win a premiership within a couple of years. Like that was sort of unknown. But we copped a fair bit of criticism for the guys who were drafted and played good footy at Richmond, but didn't emulate those two superstars in Franklin and Roughead. Well, and even Pavlich, I think, was the other one that we used to get whacked around the chops with, because we took someone before Matthew Pavlich, and who knew? Who knew?
He was Aaron Fiora.
and yeah, he's a good friend of mine, and we lived together, and hence why I didn't use his name. But yes, that's who it was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it happens at every club, though. I mean, I got a mate who was a Melbourne supporter, would bash me mercilessly, and then, you know, lo and behold, they get the first two picks in the draft, and Dusty slides through to us. It happens every year.
Right.
It always happens. So there's no – yeah. It's go on.
Yeah, that's right. That's how it works. And, who would have thought that, with hindsight, Dustin Martin wasn't the number one draft pick for that year? I mean, reflect on it, and if you remember when we weren't going that well, again, the level of maturity where they let Dustin Martin go up to GWS and tour the facilities, you know, like, that is unfathomable now. Imagine if Christian Petrarca or, you know, Melbourne let him go to another club and tour the facilities in the off-season. Like, that would just blow your mind. But that's what happened at Richmond at that point in time, where Dusty went up to GWS and had a look around.
Yeah. Let's talk about something positive. Winning back-to-back Jack Dyer medals. It must be something you're extremely proud of. Like you said before, that, you know, you were just happy to be drafted and play a game and stuff like that. So then, you know, you achieve a level of consistency and excellence over a long period, and it culminates in best and fairest. That must be something to really be proud of.
It is, and I'm immensely proud of the fact that my name was firstly on my locker, because when we got down to Punt Road, the players who'd played 100 games, I think it was a best and fairest, a premiership, and a leading goal kicker got on the locker. So initially I got my name on the locker, and it was, you know, below my dad's, which was great. So I was really proud of that. I had a tough 2003 where I struggled in the back half of the year. My fitness, it eroded, and I had a bout of osteitis pubis, which we don't hear much about nowadays, which is great. But most guys I know who had that condition, they just found that they lost their power. They lost the ability to run at a higher level and burst. And I wasn't the quickest guy, but a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a decrease in your power, a little bit of a decrease in your strength. And I started to struggle. I think I finished, after finishing in the top five for 3 or 4 years in a row, I finished 10th in the best and fairest. So didn't have a very good year. The next year I was I was really wondering what my footy would end up like where I would end up. And so I almost threw caution to the wind in many respects and just played in the manner that I felt I needed to play and I wanted to play, which shaped the rest of my career. It led to me winning the best and fairest, and I was, you know, immensely proud. The one I'm more proud of is the year after when I backed it up and worked my absolute butt off under a new coach, played centre half back all year, played on guys like, you know, Nick Riewoldt. You know, I played on Barry Hall. I played on probably the biggest of all during that year, which was Anthony Rocker. He was, you know, he towered over me, and I just worked my ass off. I put on a little bit of weight to try and hold it with him a bit. And unfortunately, I think I only won by a vote, and I only won by a vote over Richo, which was the most disappointing element. But I was, yeah, and I still am, because I get my name, you know, I get my name in Richmond history as someone who's won two best and fairest in a row. I did work my ass off the next year, and, you know, I was hoping to get three. That didn't happen, but I had a really good run for a few years there where I was able to play good footy, not just in the sense of the club and that, but I was recognised with a couple of All-Australians as well. And that's something I'm also very proud of, to have won two best and fairest and two All-Australians in a three-year gap. So, you know, it was 2004-05 for the best and fairest, and it was 2005-06 for the All-Australians. You know, I played my best footy during that period of time.
It's just a really good extended run of consistency, isn't it, to be able to do it like that? I'll just add CB, and you'll jump in at the end there. Welcome, CB. But Joel, manning up on, like you mentioned Anthony Rocker as an example, what does your mindset turn to when you walk down to the other end of the field and, like as you said, he's quite a ginormous fella and you've got a job to do to keep him quiet? That, yeah. How do you sort of combat things like that? Is it a team defence thing, or did you have sort of tricks up your sleeve that you could do to try and get it over him?
Well, there's a number of strategies and tactics that you use. I must admit, when I first went in a practice match, when I was going to play centre half back, and I went to stand next to David Neitz, he looked at me and he laughed. And we're at Princess Park, and when he looked at me and laughed, and he was shaking his head, he's going, "What the hell's going on here?" I went, "Well, that's a challenge for me, right? This is almost a win-win. He doesn't expect me to beat him. And if I lose, well, you know, I've done my best. But if I actually do beat him and then run off him, well, I'm going to be seen in a greater light." So I took a couple of approaches, and one of them was to just do my absolute best, work my ass off, and try and halve the contest. No one was expecting me to outmark David Neitz or outmark Anthony Rocker or Jonathan Brown. Just halve the contest. And as soon as I halved it, I felt that I would be at an advantage, because the ball hits the ground, and I've been playing 5 or 6 years in the AFL as a midfielder. Subsequent to that, then I would just run my ass off. And I saw Barry Hall after a game once, and he'd had a couple of beers, and he said to me, like, he said, "Joel, you are the worst person I've ever had to play on. Like, I just cannot tell you how many messages got sent out to me from the runner," which, you know, never happens. Like, I just kept on getting messages to chase him, "Don't let him run off, you know, pick him up, man him up." And you were playing on me. And so I used that as a, you know, as a bit of a template as well, that if I could run, and I was a fit midfielder, but if I could run off and the forward had to chase me, then therefore they'd be out of position if the ball turned over. There were a few times when I turned it over myself and my forward hadn't chased and went straight back over my head. And they, you know, kick a goal. But those were the risks that I was willing to take. And I was willing to try and halve the contest. I was willing to run off. I was willing to take those risks. And, you know, I remember playing fullback against Collingwood. And Paul Lecuria was a friend of mine at the time. And he said to me after the game, during the week we caught up, we were doing some work with the Salvos. Major Brendan Noddle's a friend of ours. He's still doing great work in Melbourne. And Paul Lecuria said to me, he's like, "How the hell do you get 30 possessions from fullback?" I said, "Well, mate, you just got to run off and you just got to, you know, scream for the ball and get the ball." He's like, "Yeah, but no one else does that." And I said, "Well, that's just what I do, mate." So you know, figure it out. And you know, big Anthony Rocker or Jonathan Brown, like they've had the game on their terms pretty much their entire career. They're playing centre forward. You pick me up. Yeah. I'm going to beat you in a one-on-one. I'll turn around, kick a goal. Instead of, oh, shit, the runners run out to me and tell them you've got to chase this bloke who's running off there down the left wing. It was very good. Now, we did have a bit of team defence as well because I had Andy Kellaway, Darren Gasper behind me at different times, Kel Moore, Will Thursfield, Andrew Raines, Chris Hyde, my younger brother Patrick were there. And we did do as much as we could in the sense of team defence.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a pioneer movement of just running off. You're ahead of your time. But
it wasn't that pioneering. I mean, it's just that the forwards had never really chased. I mean, you look at today's game, the forwards do the most running. They have to get all the way up into the back line and defend and create the press before they then have to sprint all the way back. And if there's a fast break and someone marks it on the wing, they turn and look and they're waiting for the forwards to sprint back down into the forward line and get in position. I find the modern game like exhausting just to watch. I can't imagine trying to play it with the speed up and down the ground.
The repetitive sprint is crazy.
To be fair, if I had the G train after me or Barry Hall, I'd probably be running a bit too, mate.
Well, that's the other thing. I actually didn't get a lot of time on Fraser Garrick. We were playing one day and he was on fire. And I think he'd gone through a couple of opponents and then they put me down there. And after he ragdolled me the first contest, they moved me immediately. And I thought, well, that's good. You know, just get ragdolled once and then you're out of there.
You're out. You played your 200th game against the Crows, who were top of the ladder back in 2006. And we won in a huge upset due to some extraordinary tactics by Plough. Played a bit of keepings off. What was it referred to? Basketball crap or something like that from the media. What was the lead-up like to that game? How well thought out and well planned was it? And how hard was it for the players to buy into? I mean, you had 20 marks. So I think you and Patrick were just waxing between yourselves at one point.
Yeah, you've got to go back a couple of weeks before that. We had a number of key injuries 3 weeks before during the game. I think Darren Gasper got injured, Andy Kellaway got injured, and we went in against Sydney the week before. I think it was round 7. And I think Will Thursfield might have played his first game or, you know, one of his earliest games. And we played Sydney and they were at their height. They beat us by 100 points, humiliated us. And so we got back after that. We got back a couple of players, I think, Not everyone was back fit, but we're playing Adelaide, who were top of the ladder, but we're playing at home. I mean, there may be a bit of misconception, but it was never a tactic. It was never a tactic to play keepings off in the back line. It was it happened because in the first quarter and a half, we got in front, that we came out during the game and we were able to work and get ourselves in front. And I think we kicked... We kicked the first couple, we got in front, and Adelaide used to play this style of game where they would roll back, where they would, if they lost it in their forward line, and Mark Rusciutto was playing forward at that stage late in his career, he would roll back to centre half back, because that's where the funnel starts, where the ball comes from the back line, it may go out wide, and it starts funneling into the goals at the other end. So they would all roll back there and what we used to call slingshot from centre-half back. Now, it was my 200th game and I think halfway through the second quarter and into the third quarter, I got the ball a few times. I just looked around. There was about 4 or 5 of us in the back line. Andrew Raines was there, Patrick was there, Chris Hyde, Andy Kellaway was there. And so instead of giving the ball back to them, because we knew that that's what they wanted to do, we, the players, just decided to kick the ball around to each other. We just kick it around. And it's one of the first games where the team had to come up and get the ball. The team had to come and effectively press into their forward line to get the ball back off the opposition, which was us. We had a world record number of marks that game. I think Andy Kellaway took the mark that broke the record of something like 180 or 190 marks in a game of footy. As you said, I had 20. I think Patrick had 15 or so. go through the stats. Everyone's had 10 to 15 marks during the game. Yeah. And we just held onto the ball. We just held onto the ball and didn't give it back to them. Unfortunately, you know, some have said previously and try to take credit for this tactic. It wasn't a tactic on the day. We used it subsequent to that. We used it in other games where we would hold on to the ball because the press hadn't been implemented at that stage. The top 20 marks in a game of footy in AFL history. Like, I've got three or four games where I've taken 19 or 20 marks because I orchestrated and I implemented it. And the backline guys trusted me. You know, they trusted to kick it to me. They trusted that I knew what I was doing. And we worked our way through to a point where we effectively had three styles or three phases of our game. One was surge, where, you know, you just got it and kicked the shit out of it. Another one was flow, where we could get into a, you know, reasonable kick, mark, handball movement. But the other one was to keep possession. It was a keepings off. And at different times in the game, we would implement that. But that was all subsequent to the round eight match. We were struggling before we went into that game, which happened to be my 200th. We held them off in the end and won, I think, by less than a goal. But it was orchestrated by the players in the back line. It was orchestrated subsequent to Adelaide's tactics, which were folding back to centre-half back, and we decided not to give them the ball back. I thought it was great. I just played kick-to-kick with my brother in my 200.
Yeah, game. I know.
Mum and dad were in the grandstand watching. We went to Prayers Blues afterwards, had a lovely meal. Like, it was like Christmas all come at once.
Yeah, exactly.
And did the P-train Kane Pettifer let everybody know about his mark for about a month after that, or how we go there with the big screamer?
I think that mark must go down in history as his greatest achievement. But he's probably still telling people about it now. It's quite a remarkable, spectacular mark. If anyone ever wants to go and have a look at that mark, and he was a very good player. I think he had 15 marks that day because, you know, we just held onto the ball. Fortunately, we were able to hold on and Adelaide, couldn't score enough. I think it was very low scoring. It might have been 7 or 8 goals each, and a few points the difference. But, you know, that's the way that footy sort of was back then. You know, it's a while ago now, where the teams were spread out. The game was sort of played more one-on-one. And even I was at the footy 2 weekends ago watching Richmond play Gold Coast. You can see 36 players inside the 50-metre arc when there's a ball up, a boundary throw in, or, you know, a ball in dispute, or a shot at goal. It's incredible. Like, we used to set up, if there was a ball up in our forward line, we'd set up to only have 2 players around it. Like, that would never happen today. And, yeah. You know, the game has just progressed so fast since I played, you know, 20-odd years ago now.
Now, not only were you a general of defence, but you had some good tricks up your sleeve as a goal kicker as well. I specifically want to talk about the goal against St Kilda, where you sold some serious candy to 3 players, breaking ankles everywhere, and slotted it from 45. Two-part question. What was going through your head when you were going through that sequence of events? And second, how often do you and Patrick debate who kicked the better goal against St Kilda? Because he had that little banana that faded away and still snuck in.
So there's no debate on who kicked the best goal. I think his is the best goal, and he'll tell you so, because of the angle. Kicking a banana from the wrong side and somehow managing to squeeze it through is almost impossible. The only bloke I've known to do that consistently was Peter Dacos, and he's a freak, and he's got a couple of good sons running around at the moment doing amazing things as well. But I think we were on top that day against St Kilda. And when I got the ball, one of the big things was I didn't use my right foot. You know, I never used my right foot. David Whedon used to say, you know, Joel, you just use your right foot to get on and off the bus. And I was like, well, you know, why would I? Why would I use it? There's no need to use it. And when, you know, 80-odd% of footballers are right-footed, the innate unconscious bias is for a player to run just to your right side, which would give a left-footer that extra fraction of a second to be able to do what you needed to do. So when the handball came out to me, I was thinking, oh, you know, I need to get onto my left because I was on the right-hand side of the field. and it was really slippery. You know, looking at the turf today, or looking at the turf 2 weeks ago, you could see it was like a bowling green. Back then, there were serious issues with the turf at Docklands. And as I tried to come back in, everyone just started slipping over. And, you know, every second step I took, I was trying to get back onto my left. And finally, I literally got onto my left and was able to kick it through. But it worked out, you know, better than I could have possibly thought. And you never dream of selling the smell cow, as we used to call it, three times inside 50 and slotting one through. I do recall, though, that I didn't even get goal of the week that week in the AFL. So therefore, Patrick's goal is clearly the best goal out of those two.
Gee, that's stiff.
All right. Have you got questions, CB, or not?
No, you boys are going beautifully. I'll just sit back and watch the show.
All right. Best seat in the house. Round 16, 2008 against Essendon. We're 6 points up with 28 seconds left. Jay Schultz passes it to you deep in the back line. You rush two behinds, wiping the game clock, and we secure the win. how did that end in your head? Did that just go, oh, yeah, bugger, this works? It was bloody funny at the time. It's still funny now.
Yeah, it was funny at the time. It was even funnier when the siren went, and I was, if you look at the, well, the screensaver that you've got behind you, Nick, it's the Essendon cheer squad. And I was still in the goal square. So yeah. I turned around and I looked at them and, oh my God, they looked like they wanted to eat their young, and I was the young. But we trained that as well. I mean, we had, as a group, Jay Schultz was there, Patrick, Andy Kellaway, Chris Hyde, Andrew Raines, a number of us had trained that. And we genuinely had trained it for a out of bounds on the full. So out of bounds on the full, you're tucked in the pocket. What can you do? Pretty much nothing, right? And all you have to do is kick it long down the line. The idea was that if it was out of bounds on the full in the pocket and you were far enough in front, or it was early enough in the game, you could simply handball it to a player behind the goals. That would therefore mean there's a point. That player can walk to the top of the goal square and can't be touched, and you can kick the ball in with, you know, 10 seconds to spare and an opportunity to go left or right from full back. We did it a few times. And that worked well. We also practiced and did it a few times, rushing the ball through. Like Patrick didn't get any credit for it, but he did it in Brisbane against the Lions. It was at the Gabba. Probably no one was really watching. The fact that I did it late in the game with, you know, 2 minutes to go and pretty much ran the entire 2 minutes off the clock just made it front and centre. Essendon versus Richmond, the media are all there. Mike Sheehan, you know, likened it to the underarm ball with Trevor Chappell against New Zealand all those years ago. And all of a sudden I was, you know, thrust into the spotlight of using the rules to an unfair advantage. And I think, frankly, I just used the rules that were available at the time, and it gave us an advantage, which meant we won the game. I mean, if you ever have a look at the vision, I waste about 2 minutes, and then finally I kick it to Geordie McMahon. Now, Geordie McMahon, not the sharpest tool in the shed, he takes the mark from full back and he plays on immediately. And you go, oh, Geordie, what are you doing, mate? Like, what are you doing? And we're still, he ran onto his right foot. He's a left footer. And he marked it out in the right-hand pocket and turned onto his right foot. Fortunately, the siren went. All he had to do was throw the ball in the air. But it was something we'd trained. It was something that we'd worked on. And as a group, we'd talked about it. And I was actually on the bench with about three and a half minutes to go. And I just said to him, hey, just get me back on. I reckon I know how we can sort this out. And we ended up sorting it out all right.
Very good.
That's so good.
Very good. The following week, round 17 against Brisbane, you were the hero again, but this time playing as a forward. 3 points down, 31-minute mark. You take a mark, 40 metres out, you're lining up for your fourth. How do you, obviously there's some nerves involved. How do you set yourself? What's the mentality? I mean, because I'm probably the most mentally weak bloke out there. All my golf partners will tell you that. How do you control yourself in a situation like that and get it steady? Because some people can do it and some can't.
Yeah, it was an interesting game. And, you know, Richo's still upset that he didn't get any credit because he kicked three in the last quarter, took like a couple of massive contested marks, kicked a goal from the 50-metre line. I got a couple in the last quarter from a holding the ball and an intercept mark, and then I get the last one of the day. So I got, you know, I got all the credit, and he's still filthy with me. I took a goal off him in 1996 in round 22 that was, you know, if he had kicked it, he would have kicked 92 for the season, not 91. He doesn't hold a grudge and doesn't have a long memory. But your question of, you know, how do you steady yourself? It's just through practice and repetition. You know, like I remember Greg Norman was the great white shark and the champion when I was growing up. And the thing that stuck in my mind forever was he would play 18 holes and then go and hit 400 balls because it was practice, and it was perfect practice to make perfection. Now, I'm not saying we were ever perfect at Richmond, but we used to practice goal kicking a lot. And David Whedon was probably the best at that, that you had to have a routine, that you had to know which foot you started on when you stood there and looked up at the goals. And I used to have a routine, you know, I can still recite it to you today. Now, I didn't follow it that day. You know, I put in an extra couple of steps, but I had a routine, a goal kicking routine, and I practiced every week. Darren Gasper used to do the same. And every time Darren Gasper got a shot at goal, he would actually kick a goal because he had a really good routine. And he was able to execute it. He knew what he needed to do. So, you know, that day, and it was great because I've reflected on that, and it comes up every now and then. Richard Tambling, who's a friend of mine and he's living in the territory now, he kicked the ball to me when I was in the forward line, and it was a very nice pass, hit me on the chest. I turned around, lined up, took my breath, started on my, you know, first step was on my right foot, put a little skip in the middle, but had my routine, and it went through the middle. The worst part of the whole thing was Jack Riewoldt kissed me after the game. Like, it was, you know, the siren went not long after that, and we sort of, you know, everyone came in and had a cuddle, and Jack slapped a kiss on me. I was like, mate, don't ever do that again. Like, you know, that's not how we celebrate.
Jesus. He does get excited. Yeah, tic-tac first, that's it. Now, I think if I read correctly, you had a big hand in the free agency system in your time or being at the AFLPA. How did that all sort of come about, and are you happy with how it's still working today?
Yeah, look, I had a really, really important role there at the Players Association as an executive member and then as the president for a few years, and I really enjoyed that. The free agency was effectively workers' rights, and I'm a huge advocate for workers' rights, a huge advocate for, you know, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, that you need to be safe and every worker needs to go home after their shift. And what we were trying to say was that players effectively as workers don't have mobility with their employment. Any other employer is able to ply their trade and then go to another company. So let's just say you work for company A. If company B are willing to give you better paying conditions, then you can leave company A and go to company B. That wasn't the case in the AFL, and players were restricted in their movements through the trade, through the draft. And what we wanted to implement was that after 7 or 8 years, depending, 7 or 8 years of service to a club, then that player earns the right to then negotiate in good faith with other clubs and not be penalised for that element. Now, it seems reasonable. Like, imagine if you worked for 8 years at AMP and then you wanted to go to NAB. No one in their right mind would say, oh, no, you can't do that. Even if you worked for 6 months at AMP and then wanted to move to NAB, like, notwithstanding a contract, but you would probably be able to do it. You would, if they offered you twice as much money, well, the same job, but twice a month, you'd probably move over. Now, AFL is very, very different, and we've got the salary cap, we've got the draft, we've got all these things that are there to even up the competition, and you know, it's the any given Sunday theme, but there's got to be an element of self-determination in what a player can do after they've given a certain amount of service to the club. And look, I think it's working reasonably well. There was an intervention that the AFL implemented when the GWS and the Gold Coast Suns came in, that stripped the entire competition of first and second round draft picks and put them all up on the, you know, the Gold Coast and the GWS. And we've only just seen them filter all the way back. I mean, where would Richmond be today without Dion Prestia, Josh Caddy and Tom Lynch? I don't think Richmond would have won three premierships. Maybe one, maybe two, but I don't think they would have won three. But that's because free agency allowed those guys after a period of time at the Gold Coast to then filter out back into the clubs. And look at all the different clubs who've got players from GWS or Gold Coast in the last 5 or 6 years. That's fundamentally because of free agency. They've been able to move.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we would have won three if we didn't acquire those players. So, although some people in the media named Kane Corn still think that Dion Prestia was a poor trade, but I think the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, oh, look, Dion Prestia, from my perspective, has been one of the best pickups the club has, you know, had in many a days as a trade. You know, Tom Lynch is probably the most impactful trade in recent memory to come in and do what he did in those 2 years and secure two premierships. Like, that's a phenomena. But Dion Prestia, for his body of work since coming from the Gold Coast, I think it's just been exceptional.
Well, I think statistically, Prestia is our second best performer finals-wise behind Dustin Martin, such as his significance in finals.
Yeah, and, you know, he doesn't accumulate as many possessions as some others, but his influence on the game is significant, and he makes others better players, it seems.
Hmm. I'm going to change direction a little bit here. In 2012, you joined the AFL as the game analysis manager and were a member of the match review panel.
Yeah, that's my penance for rushing two behinds. I pay my penance.
Grading the incidents on a weekly basis, it seems to change every few years. Was it complex back in the time? And do you want to take it back over now?
No, I don't. I don't want to be involved anymore. As you may know, I'm now in politics in the Northern Territory, so I'm a local member and I represent my constituents in the Northern Territory. So I won't be entertaining the match review panel. Is Michael Christian still doing it?
Yes.
Yeah. Apparently. So good luck to Michael. When I was doing it, there was three of us there. There was Mark Fraser as the chair, Des Gleeson, the former racing steward from the VRC, and myself. We had a couple of seasons, and it was always interesting. Rod Austin used to always, was also part of the panel, former Carlton champion. And so, we had a diverse set of ex-players and steward, which was good. I disagreed with them a lot. They disagreed with me a lot, but we had to come to a consensus. And one of the unfortunate parts was if I disagreed, I then was tasked with doing a AFL.com segment most weeks about the MRP. And I had to say, that striking charge that we leveled on, you know, let's say player X, oh, that was withdrawn because of insufficient force. And, you know, the guy would just look at me and shake his head, like, how is that insufficient force? He's whacked him around the chops and blah, blah, blah. But I had to hold the line. It was good training for politics. So that was good. But I was on the Laws Committee for 3 years and we had, a lot of conversations about the interchange bench. I noticed that there's no talk about interchange much anymore. My one little baby that I always talked about pretty much every meeting was that I could never understand why we would stop the game if a player put their foot on the line when they were kicking out from fullback. That the issue that the Laws Committee were interested in was the free-flowing nature of the game, and we didn't want to have congestion. We didn't want to have 36 players inside 50 and the ball not get out. Yet we would stop the game and ball it up at the top of the square if a player kicking in after a point put their foot on the line. Now, I didn't get much traction. I used to all just sort of grumble and groan at the end of each meeting when I'd bring that up in the agenda item of all other business. But I see today that it doesn't matter anymore. You can just walk out and you can just kick it down and they put the man on the mark another 5 or 6 metres back, which is opening up the game. And I think it's one of the best things for footy to open the game up. But it's also an interesting one because players are getting possession when they walk out from fullback. And I remember little kids coming up to me at some stage when Supercoach sort of got going and I was accumulating possessions from the back line. They would say to me, Joel, play on from fullback this week because you're my Supercoach captain and I need you to get the most kicks. So anyone who kicks in regularly, I think, is going to be a Supercoach captain.
Yeah. Well, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and now the step is over the line. We're okay. You actually just talked about what the next question was going to be. You are a member of Parliament. How did that come about? And obviously you're enjoying it.
Yeah, I am enjoying it. I've always been interested in politics. I grew up in a political household. You know, I remember Hawke and Keating through that that era, you know, in the 80s into the mid-90s. I lamented the 96 through to 2007 under the Conservative government of Howard and was buoyed by Kevin 07. And we had our little coffee shop, Birdie Num Nums, and the next day Birdie Num Nums. It was free coffee for anyone who wanted a free coffee and supported the Labor Party. So I've always been a strong Labor supporter. I've always been interested in politics. I've had some good friends and mentors who are, you know, political, have either been ex-union officials or ex-politicians. So that's always been part of you know, my interest outside of footy. Representing the players as a Players Association executive member and president is what it's about, advocacy. And so I've taken that challenge on here. And, you know, we've got a really difficult environment in the Northern Territory. There's a lot of disadvantage. There's a lot of people who are living, you know, in third world conditions, out bush and living and sleeping rough in Darwin and across the territory. And so I'm, you know, keen to put my shoulder to the wheel in a political environment and try and do something and help make the lives of other people better. Working people, disadvantaged people, all those that may need a little bit of support and a little bit of help, you know, the great things of superannuation and Medicare, where you can actually get free health cover, that there is compulsory savings for retirement. These are all strong Labor values that I believe in.
You're preaching to the converted here.
Well, it's not an Essendon podcast, is it? It's a Richmond podcast.
No. Yeah. Myself and CB have quite a lot of discussions about the political side of life, almost like a so, yeah. And obviously, with what you're doing, the support of the family, with all sort of this, you know, the playing career outside of the career, it obviously makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, you can't do it without a strong family. And my wife and I have been together for a long time. We've got 4 kids now, which is fabulous. I feel like I drive. From time work finishes, I pretty much drive to and from sporting events and political events. So tonight, you know, I dropped my daughter off at a sporting training session. I went straight to a function. I left the function. I went and picked my son up and, you know, came home and logged on for this podcast. Life's busy. We get to do plenty of things in the territory because of our proximity. We call it a two song commute up here, which means, you know, two songs and you're there. You know, this podcast has been going for like 45 minutes. I could have driven 100 kilometers almost in 45 minutes once I get out of Darwin. You know, the speed limit once you get out of Darwin is 130. The speed limit just out of Darwin is 110. And there's so much you can do in the territory, and it's a wonderful place to grow up. I'm sitting here. I've got just a polo shirt on and some shorts. I'm outside. It's about 29 degrees. Beautiful. The territory is fabulous for me and the family. And I'm in a, you know, a political world now where I'm hoping to contribute. And I'm in a Labor government, so that's even better. You want to be in government when you're in politics, and that's what I've got the fortunate opportunity to be at the moment.
Someone did make comment earlier about being jealous of you having even a fan on in the background at night time, whereas we're all rugged up with jumpers on down here. So,
yeah, the fans are on. I actually turned the other one off because it does a bit of strobe lighting with that spotlight. But once we get off, I'll turn that other fan on. And you know, we live our lives. A lot of it is outdoors. You know, there's two sets of thongs in the Northern Territory. You know, there's your casual thongs and there's your, you know, your good thongs, or your going out thongs. So I had my going out thongs on before, so it's a fabulous life. It's a really good, you know, it's like a big country town. Everyone knows everyone, and we love it. We just love it up here.
We call them work boots here in the Latrobe Valley, Joel.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I think they might be called moccasins or ugg boots as well.
All right, before we wrap up, I do want to get your thoughts on the current crop of Tigers and I suppose what your thoughts were on the success of 17, 19 and 20. Obviously, the three flags in 4 or 5 years was a pretty good effort. How have you seen the Tigers in recent history and what are you thinking of 2023 so far?
I think it was slightly more than a pretty good effort. It was bloody unbelievable and amazing. We got down for the 2019 premiership, and I have a vivid memory of the half-time line-up to the toilet and the line-up to the bar and the line-up to the pie shop. And in the bowels of the MCG, as many of you will know, there is a lot of nervousness at halftime of any final, let alone any, you know, grand final that Richmond's in. I went down there and I caught up with Greg Tivendale and a couple of other guys, Robbie Taylor, and we were just standing there and we were just looking around. Everyone was relaxed. Most people were smiling and happy to sort of just cruise around, and it was just completely yellow and black. That's the moment that defined the three premierships for me, that Richmond people were happy and they weren't a blubbering mess at halftime in tears that we might lose, that we're 5 goals up and we still might lose. And that's what the players and the coaching staff, Brendan and Peggy, did. They gave Richmond people, all the fans, all the supporters that I met over the journey, all the people that you know, just have, like, it's 5 years probably of just sheer pure joy from watching their team play and, you know, play the brand of footy that was just phenomenal. And to see Gustin Martin play in the manner that he played for the club, I think is going to be, in hindsight, he'll go down as the greatest AFL footballer ever.
Just a side question. I know you mentioned Kuda played an awesome month of football back when you were playing, but is anyone going to top Dusty's level of football across those three grand finals? He was just God mode. It was unbelievable what he was able to do.
No, so interestingly, and you'll all know the stats better than me, but not only did he play midfield forward, he played forward in one game against Brisbane and kicked 6 goals. Not only did he win 3 premierships and 3 North Smiths, he won a Brownlow in there. He also won a Best and Fairest. He won the Gary Ayres medal for best player in the finals 3 times. So he didn't just pull 3 great games out in the grand final. He was best player in the final series for those 3 premierships. Amongst everything else, I think that just puts him in the upper echelon. You know, the greatest player of the last century was Lee Matthews. Never won a Norm Smith. Didn't win a Brownlow. Didn't win a Brownlow and Norm Smith, a premiership, and a Best and Fairest all in the one year. No one's ever done that. And Martin, I just simply say he'll go down as the greatest player in history. Once he finishes and once we stop and reflect on his career, and especially those 5 years, it'll just be unsurpassed. No one will reach it. It's like 99.94. It is unattainable ever again.
I think you couldn't have summarised that any better if you tried. I think, yeah, he was just in elite areas. And I think it will be good to reflect and rewatch those DVDs, you know, as the years go on, you just appreciate it more and more. But before we finish up, we better talk about the game this week. Joel, the Cats, Friday night. How do you think the Tigers are going to fare?
Well, they need Lynch, and they haven't got him. Riewoldt needs a big guy next to him. Until Lynch is back, they're going to struggle to kick enough goals to beat teams that score heavily. They do need to do some goal kicking practice as well. They maybe need to get a routine and start on their right foot and take 7 steps and then kick. But that's probably not going to happen overnight. I think you look at where Richmond are now, and I watched the Gold Coast game, and they just didn't look to have the same spark as a few years ago. Now, that's understandable because those guys are 3 years older. Since 2017, they're 6 years older. But they're going to need to get a number of new players coming through so that we can have a bit of joy as supporters over the next 5 years. Geelong seem to be in good form. I've hardly seen them play this year, but they've still got a bunch of good players. And over the last month, they've kicked into some form. I reckon they've probably got the best player in the competition at the moment in Jeremy Cameron getting around. I don't know who picks him up, Dylan Grimes or Noah Bolter, but they need to stop him. But then they've got bloody big Tom Hawkins, who I don't know how old he is now, 34 or 35, continues to dominate the air. And that's just because he's so good and so big. But it'll be a tough game. I tip the Tigers every week. I run a tipping competition, and I'm about five down on the leader. That's because Richmond have lost five games this year that I've tipped them. And it's a bit of a running joke, but black and yellow runs through my blood and in my veins. So I'm just enjoying watching them, enjoying being part of the club. Even doing this tonight just gives me a little bit of a relapse into my time playing there, which I enjoyed so much. So thank you for having me on. I hope the Tigers can win by a point. I mean, there's nothing better than beating any team by 100 points. Well, one thing, beating them by 1 point. Or beating Collingwood by 1 point.
Especially Geelong. I will do a quick round the room. We'll get some tips and quick thoughts before we wrap up. CB, give you some airtime, mate. What do you think of the game this week against the Cats?
I agree with Joel. I don't see how we're going to stop the two big cats up forward. I think that's our real pain point at the moment. And as much as Noah Bolter is a fantastic young developing key defender, I think it's defensively is where we're going to struggle to stop those big guys. I don't see why we can't match them out of the guts. And, you know, the forward line's a work in progress, but I've got to say Samson Ryan is seriously showing something. Really liking watching how he's going about at the moment. And just on Noah Cumberland, he's copped a bit of heat, but Joel hit it on here before. We're missing Tom Lynch. So all of a sudden, Cumberland's gone from taking the third or fourth best defender. He's probably copping the second best defender every week now. So he's on a very big learning curve as well. And we just need to keep that in mind. He's played under 20 games and we need to keep it in perspective. So unfortunately, look, onward, Joel. I hope there's 30 seconds to go. We're 2 points up. We've got the ball. We walk it over the line, burn 30 seconds and win by a point. That's about the best case scenario we can get.
Let's wind back the clock. I'm with you, CB. EJ, what's your final thoughts for this game on Friday night and who are you tipping?
Still recovering from the effects of COVID. Yeah. That mute button's been getting a workout tonight. Look, I'm with our great Collingwood friend, Morgan Ashley, who's watching tonight. I also tip the Tigers by 76 points, which is what the margin that she's got. But I think she means the other way. Look, I'm with Samson Ryan, what we're seeing is he's getting an accelerated development at the highest level, which is fantastic. I'm not as concerned. Yes, I think the Geelong are going to kick a score. But defensively, we've actually held up okay this year. It's more about not being able to kick the score ourselves. So, yes, just Tigers by 76.
And I would love to see us get over the line by five points. We'll do it. Kick after the siren. Jack Rewalk can slot one from 55 on the boundary maybe and just put a dagger through. So, now, it should be an interesting contest. Hopefully, the defence holds up well. But I agree, Joel, we need Tom Lynch back pronto. But you don't obviously want to rush him either in case the foot flares up again. But, Joel, thank you so much again for your time tonight, mate. Really, really appreciate it. Your insights, your wisdom was outstanding. You might have seen all the comments flooding through. People were super appreciative of your stories and your time. So, very much appreciated.
I haven't seen the chat coming through. I'll have to have a look, but no, thanks guys. I really enjoy it. I mean, I had my little relapse last or 2 weeks ago when I went on the front bar, got to watch Richmond. We went down there to training. I took a group of guys from Darwin who were in Melbourne to Punt Road, and I was just privileged to be able to go in there again. Brendan Gale and the team invited us in. We stood on the balcony, we watched training, because Punt Road's my home, and that's where I love to be, and it was just great. So thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And Tigers by 76 points, I'll take that.
We'll take that every day of the week. No worries. Thank you so much, Joel, again. Thank you, EJ and CB. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Much appreciated. And hopefully we're back on Monday with a big win under our belt and we can get stuck into the Cats with a nice little loss. So thanks for watching, everybody. And until next time, go Tigers.
Go Tigers.
Go Tigers. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.